know, I'm still a professor at Harvard. I can't help it. And so I'm going to do less addressing and more interacting and a little more teaching. And so I hope that's okay. So if you're hoping for a 40-minute oration, you'll be disappointed. Probably some of you are relieved now. So that's good. Oh, good. But I want to say a few things as a way of starting, but I really see myself as learning on the journey still, too. And I'm here to talk because hopefully I can model what it's like to be thinking about these questions and learning about differences of all kinds, and engaged in a process of not only learning about the world, but learning about myself. What are the things that I still have yet to discover about who I am, who God has made me, and what I know, and what I don't know, what I have yet to learn. And so I love the name of this week, even, because it speaks to me. So what I have to say today, I know I can't help but be the president, and that's actually a good thing, and I want to use the president's office for good things like this. But I also want to model, I think for myself, what it is to be on the journey and learning how we can redeem and renew the world that we live in. And so I don't really say what I'm about to say as the expert, as a person who's arrived, as a person who's got it all figured out. In fact, to do this well, to lead well, whether it's a campus community or a little small group who's talking about this, where it needs to start is with disclosure about what you believe, but also disclosure about where you've been and what you've had to learn. And so please accept my comments in that spirit, and as someone that God is not done with, God is still working on. So when I think about my own journey on matters of diversity, on these questions, I really go back to my childhood, kind of some of the earlier memories that I have. I grew up until I was 10 in South San Diego, which was kind of North Tijuana. My dad was a social worker in that part of the country, and I went to a bilingual school in South San Diego, and you know, was very aware when I was going to school, okay, wow, people speak a different language than what they do at home, and there are differences all around me, and I don't remember very often feeling frightened about those differences. I remember feeling really curious and kind of interested and kind of engaged, but also there were moments that I remember, even as an elementary school kid, walking into a room, walking into a group of people hanging around the monkey bars, and the conversation would stop. And then I would realize I was the only non-Latino in the little group. I didn't know the word Latino then when I was in first grade, but I remember these moments of seeing and feeling these things. And later on in my life, I was actually able to see a group of white people that I was a part of, and an African-American walked in, and the conversation stopped. And actually, we weren't even talking about anything related to race, but I remember thinking, that just seems awful, the way that conversation stopped, and how can they help but think that that's what we're talking about? And it helped me that I had some experiences on the other side. Now, those experiences by no means meant anything other than about being enlightened or anything other than that, but they just gave me some other reference points to begin to get started. I'll start with, I think, one of the truths that I was able to discover in those early days, and these are truths that I've come to articulate better as a person of faith, as I've sought to really integrate my faith more deeply to how I think about these issues. And in fact, my faith is inextricably linked with what I believe about our call to create a new human community. So I'll start with the presupposition, and it's one that you Calvin students probably hear a lot. But I start with the belief and the conviction that all human beings are made in the image of God. Now think about that powerful claim. All human beings are made in the image of God. And then look around Actually, look around this room. Just get up. Stand up. Now, this is God's artistry and creativity in just what you see. Just turn around. Look at each other. Derek, do a 360. Just turn around. Maybe look at people's backs. All right. You can sit down now. But I look out and I just see beautiful things. God's artistry in every face. And I rejoice, actually, I really enjoy the fact that no two people are exactly alike, even identical twins. Not exactly. I think that's wonderful. That variety that God's put in our way and in our place. And so, as you look at each other, remember, we see the images of God. Okay? I look, and I see God's artistry, I see the infinite creativity of a loving God. And God looked at all this and said, this is good. This is very good. And so, that's where I start. That's not where I started when I was a little kid, but that's where I start today. And I don't even remember when I started to really integrate that. But that became an important integration point for me, and it's where I start. That God created beauty, and he called it good. Beauty in each person. Now, I had an interesting experience. When I lived in Sweden, it was a very homogeneous culture. Okay, very homogeneous culture, very Swedish. So it's a very homogeneous culture, and you know, blonde, blue-eyed. And I remember we had friends who had a child at the same time that we did. They were Swedes, and maybe a month or two younger, the baby was. And we didn't really see the baby a lot when he was first born. But by the time he was about 6 months old, we went over to their house, and I had facial hair, and I had. I was who I was, and you know, my wife's Norwegian ancestry, so she fit in rather well there. But I put my face in front of the baby's face, and the baby started to cry. That was, you know, that happens to me a lot. But what was really interesting is what came out of our Swedish friend's mouth. They said, "Oh, it's because you're so dark." And it was a fascinating comment, partly because I had never thought of myself that way. But they did. And then I thought to myself, what does this even mean? Does this baby even really think about those kind of things? Is it because I'm not their mother or father, or is there something else going on? But I was fascinated that it was a nearly a race-based explanation that was offered as to why this baby was crying. And it led me to reflect in a much deeper way about the next point, but it's really the way that any kind of enmity develops between people. And so this baby, you know, I don't know why he cried. It may be just that I'm ugly. You know? but if whatever we do in our brains, whatever the brain does to form an understanding of difference, I suspect something was happening there. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm certainly not a prenatal psychologist. I don't know what the neuroscience of difference is. I don't know how children react. But it led me to think in some significant ways about these differences that I just called beautiful and wonderful and important, part of God's artistry. But something enters the world that estranges people. And it's led me to the study of intercultural differences. And my background is international relations, so I have been interested in intercultural differences. And I'm interested in how those intercultural differences divide us and the things that we can do to bring them together. But I'm also really interested in how people develop and change along these lines. How do they grow in their capacity to appreciate difference? And how do organizations change? Because that's what's really important. How do cultures change? How do organizations change? And how do people change? And so it's actually turned out that those kinds of questions are quite relevant for the work that I'm doing. I've got to understand a lot about how do I change and grow, but I've also got to think a lot about how does Calvin College change and grow and develop. Milton Bennett, who has studied intercultural sensitivity and studied differences, has some pretty profound insights. And I can see these So I'm going to walk through a couple of parts of his model so that, and integrate it a little bit more with the theological principles, because I've really come to believe that this model of difference explains a lot of where we are on the journey. One of the critiques I would give just out of the gate is it describes six stages of development, and it suggests somehow that it kind of leads people to think that there's a linearity to it all, and I don't believe that. I actually can see myself sometimes in different parts of the model. But the model does, I think, explain or help us to understand what maybe our aspirations should be along these lines, and so I find it helpful. It also helps us to explain when we run into roadblocks and we get stuck. And so the first stage of the model is what he calls denial of difference. In other words, it's the belief or the conviction that individuals experience, the only culture they really experience as the real one is theirs. Okay? Everything else, other cultures, either are not noticed or are understood in an undifferentiated and very simplistic manner. People in this stage of development are generally uninterested in cultural difference, but when confronted with difference, their seemingly benign acceptance of difference may change to aggressive attempts to avoid difference or eliminate it altogether. And most of the time, this is a result of physical or social isolation. In other words, people are together with the same people all the time. And so they're not really challenged to integrate difference, to understand difference. And very often, people that are in socially isolated or very homogeneous groups, they're not with people who challenge them or challenge their assumptions. And so this is, I think, this explains a lot of a human problem and why we can't really embrace as human beings in a very regular way this fundamental principle that we are created in the image of God and all things in it are good. All things in that image in people are good. And so this denial of difference, I think, explains a lot. I mean, first of all, it's rooted in sin, which I'll elaborate in a little bit more. But it explains why we get stuck. And it suggests, actually, how important it is to have difference in your life if you're going to really grow. Now, the powerful thing about our redemptive project here is the two things I really believe in that make a difference and help people grow. And I believe this in part because it's really helped me grow, is education and relationships. Those are the two fundamental pieces that have to be a part of a growth and development strategy. You can read all you want and have all the right ideas, but if you're not in meaningful relationships characterized by differences that are important and significant and valuable, it's going to be pretty hard to grow. And I know in my own work life, when I have been in more socially homogeneous work groups and everyday work environments, my intercultural abilities, my abilities to work across difference, my abilities to recognize privilege and racism in my own life, I'll unpack some of those terms in a minute, diminish. And when I start to get in more diverse work environments, more frequent relationships with people different than me, I grow. At 46, I grow, and I need it, and it's still really important. So that's another principle that I think I would say is foundational. Remember, we want a diverse community here. We want it for a variety of reasons. We want it for kingdom reasons, but we believe people grow. All of us grow when we're together and we're working in the context of differences that are important. The second stage that this model of development that Bennett refers to is called the defense against difference stage. This is a higher level, slightly higher level of development, ironically, because at least this person's acknowledging that there is some difference. Okay, but now instead of being in a position where you're not even in acknowledgement of difference, a person sees the difference as a threat. Okay, and so listen to this description. One's own culture is experienced therefore as the most evolved. So there's a person now that's aware of another culture, but the culture I'm from is the most evolved. It's the one that gets it. It's the best way to live. And so this position is characterized by a dualistic us-them way of thinking, and frequently accompanied by overt negative stereotyping. And often when we think of a racist in the kind of Jim Crow era time, or in, you know, when we think of Nazism or other kinds of extreme forms of racism, it's characterized by this stage of development, okay? And it's characterized by this dualistic thinking. So this kind of person or person in this stage will openly belittle differences among their between their culture and another culture. They'll denigrate race, gender, any other indicator of difference. So it's a position of hostility. And people in this position are very interested in acting aggressively against it. Now, a variation of this position, I actually have seen this too when I work with students, especially when they're going in overseas context or they work in a service learning context. They'll romanticize the culture they're in and denigrate the one that they're from. It's just a reversal of the same thing. The problem with that way of thinking is it's still a belief that there's a superior culture and inferior cultures. Okay, so that's the problem. It can be your own, or you can sort of privilege another one. And I can think of times in my own life, particularly in my teenage years, where there were other cultures I would encounter, and I would think, you know, that's really a better culture. That's way more style in that culture than mine. Way more rhythm in that culture than mine. Taking very simple, simplistic little things and elevating them, and thinking that somehow that level of that recognition or acknowledgement, that my ability to see that and value that and privilege that meant somehow that I was more enlightened. Okay. And that's a problem too. And so let's talk about sin. Because I think these positions, these ways of thinking are evidences of sin, but they're also part of the human condition. Okay? They're part of where we find ourselves. So this is truth number two for me. Something that I think about every day is that sin entered the world and corrupted every human soul and every created thing, including human relationships. Okay. Now, often when we talk about sin, we individualize it. And in American culture, more so than any culture I know, we have a tendency to think of sin as a very personal, individual characteristic. Rather than, as we Reformed people believe in, as something that's pervasive and systemic and structural and cultural and influences all things. So our tendency is to think of sin as individualized. And in some traditions, I think that's more pervasive than others. But my belief of sin is that it doesn't leave anything untouched. And because of sin, human beings just enslave one another. Okay? And they privilege some races and make some races inferior. And human beings then create structures and rules that categorize people according to their race. Notice I'm using present tense still. Okay? They categorize people according to race, gender, social class, level of education, all kinds of differences we use to create these hierarchies and rules. And sin causes humans to ignore God's reality, this reality that every human being is created in His image. And so we deny it, we forget it. And we replace it with a false reality. And this is what social scientists and scholars call the social construction of the reality. And you, a lot of you know about this and you learn about this in your courses, but for those of you that may not hear it, or know what it is, in this reality, people, knowingly or unknowingly, they either create the rules or come to inhabit a system of privilege and subordinate the less privileged. They either know it and do it, or more often than not, they protect it and preserve it without being aware of it. And so right now you're probably thinking, yeah, I've heard of this. Jim Crow laws in the South and slavery, but it's a thing of the past. It's not. If you believe, like I do, that sin is present, it's active, it's among us, it's with us, it's corrupted me, it's corrupted our systems, it's corrupted our cultures, then it's not consistent to think that we've overcome it, or that it's a thing of the past. It's alive and well and with us every day. Okay? And because we're sinners, we have a tendency also to think that we're above these problems. It's not our problem. It's somebody else's problem. We're not racist or sexist. We think we're enlightened. We think that we have no sin, which is a sin. Okay? But we're all in denial about this very often. Okay? If you're white and male like me, it can be hard to see it because white males in our culture are the privileged ones. They still are. I still am. And what does that mean? What does that privilege mean? Well, there's a ton of examples, but I'll give you a few that are commonly referred to. But I've never walked through a store and been followed by a proprietor because of the color of my skin. That's never happened to me. I've never walked through a store and been followed around. I have sat in a store and watched people be followed around. But it's never happened to me. I don't have to worry about that. When I pull up next to a police officer on the road in Grand Rapids, I don't worry. I don't even think I could be pulled over, unless I was speeding earlier. But I don't even think about it. That's not a burden I have to bear. It's not a worry I have to have. Okay? That's privilege. That's a burden I don't have to bear. Okay? I've never been denied an application to rent because of the color of my skin. Whenever I've been denied anything, I don't sit and wonder if it was because of my race. As a male, if I'm forceful and determined in my argumentation, nobody calls me a bitch. But if you're a woman, and you are, how many times have you heard that? Okay. That's privilege, right? I'm forceful, I'm determined, I'm decisive if I do those things. But if a woman does those things, there's something else. That's privilege. So for those of us who are in the privilege categories, it can be pretty hard to see privilege. You don't experience the other end. Okay? And so these are just a few examples, and I'm happy to give you more. I will say that this is stuff I was unaware of. I was unaware of it in college when I started college, my college experience. And I still remember in my freshman year befriending, I think it was the dean in your role, a guy by the name of Gordon Watanabe, and I had grown up for the rest of my life on Bainbridge Island, which has a fascinating story in its own right in Washington State. Bainbridge Island was one of the first places that Japanese Americans were rounded up at the beginning of World War II. And it was a stunning thing. It's a funny community. It's a community that is, you know, when you live on an island, everybody that lives there is from there. You know, anyone passing through, you all know that they're tourists. And you come to know everybody very, very well. Close-knit relationships and close-knit community. And for sure, there was racism and sin as part of this community, like any other community. But when the U.S. military came and began to round up families and take them out of their homes, this was right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and people were scared. And this was an island in the Puget Sound. And people were scared, but there were a few courageous individuals. In fact, the only known editorial in the month of December denouncing the U.S. government for the rounding up of people on Bainbridge Island was written by a man on Bainbridge Island in the Bainbridge Review, the little paper there, named Walt Woodward. And he denounced the sinful act of rounding these people up. And then he received death threats upon death threats and was treated very cruelly. But it was nothing compared to the experience of Japanese Americans, second and third generation Japanese Americans, that were rounded up and taken off to camps for 4 years. Many of them lost their property, lost their businesses, lost their homes. And many didn't return, but a lot of them did. So this was a story I grew up with, learning about this. I was one of my good friends in high school, was a third-generation Japanese-American, and his mother and father were taken off to internment camps, and they came back to Bainbridge Island. So this was a story that was very much a part of my experience. And so because I knew these stories, I'd grown up in, where I did in San Diego, you know, I kind of thought, I get it. And I remember meeting Gordon Watanabe. He was a very interesting guy. And we were walking together off the campus, and somebody drove by in a car and yelled out the window, "Boat people go home." Okay, now this was in the 80s, so there were a lot of Asian Americans were of Vietnamese origin at that time in the Pacific Northwest. A lot of refugees that had resettled in the Pacific Northwest were Vietnamese in origin. And I remember Gordon was furious, and he had tears in his eyes, and it was a really shocking experience. And I felt terrible for him. But then as he began to unpack for me all that experience meant to him, I started realizing, oh, there's a lot more here that I learned. First of all, he confessed to me. I said, "I'm so sorry this happened. And I, you know, this is a horrible thing, and I'm sorry this happened." And he said, "I'm furious right now," but he goes, "You know what I'm mad at in myself is that my first response was, I am not Vietnamese, I'm Japanese American." He said, "I've racialized my response, and I'm just kind of working through that right now." So he's confessing and telling me, like, ooh. And I'm sitting there just kind of going, wait, he's upset at himself, and this, you know, what's going on here? It was a really powerful experience. And I said, I feel really bad. And he said, "No, it's good." And then later he told me, he said, "I wanted to just scream at you right now at that moment and say, but you don't know. You don't know what it's like. You don't know what it's like to be me. You don't know what it's like to hear this. You don't know the pain of this." So later he told me that, and because we became friends, and he's one of my closest friends still. So later he explained that to me, and I suddenly started to see things all around me, and I started to realize that the number of ways that I had taken my privileges for granted. And so sin, the way it manifests itself now is a continuation of the structures of privilege and the things that we don't think about, those of us that have those privileges. And it's one of the reasons that we can get stuck, because I think now as a culture, we know that Jim Crow is bad. And we know that discrimination is bad. And it's kind of the accepted cultural wisdom. And people know that there are things that they shouldn't say, right? And you'll hear people say, "Well, I'm not a racist, but..." Or, "I shouldn't say this, but..." So people even know they're not supposed to say and do certain things. So with that level of awareness, what's very difficult is to go in deeper and to go farther. And the only way that you're going to do that, I believe, is to begin being really vulnerable and begin being open and honest. Because what we end up doing, which is referred to by Bennett as the minimization of difference, okay, what we end up doing is kind of making it not a big deal. And I think it's pretty common. I watch out for it all the time. But it's where we emphasize the experience of similarity outweighs the experience of difference. Particularly if we've come to a point of realizing differences, people can exploit differences and those can be hurtful and harmful. We start to know that. But then our strategy is to minimize those differences. We say, you know, people are people. You know, I really come to believe people are people. And there's not much that separates us or divides us. And so differences are minimized. And so people will recognize the superficial cultural differences. They say, "You know what? I'm good at diversity. I like Mexican food." They'll say, I like this music. I like those customs. It's really fun. You know, I think when I think back to some of the things that I've said and thought when I was in elementary school, in the culture that I was in was like that. Or interacting with Japanese Americans where I lived on Bainbridge Island, I think I was minimizing that. I would appreciate differences that were very safe and easy. And what we tend to do when we're minimizing is emphasize the human similarity in physical structure, psychological needs. You know, we all got to eat, right? You know, we're all the same. And universal values. You know, everybody loves kids. We all love kids. Kids are great. Get over it. And people at this position then are likely to assume that they're no longer ethnocentric because of this. I'm good. I'm not ethnocentric anymore. And they tend to overestimate their tolerance for differences and underestimate the effect or privilege. They underestimate privilege. And this was my experience. This is what I still struggle to see, is I have underestimated my privileges. Okay. In other words, as explained by the Canadian Center for Intercultural Learning, people who adopt this point of view generally approach intercultural situations with the assurance that a simple awareness of the fundamental patterns of human interaction will be sufficient to assure success in relationships and communication. Okay. Such a viewpoint is ethnocentric because it presupposes that the fundamental categories of behavior that we have are absolute, and these categories are actually our own. Okay. Let me unpack what that means for a minute. It's ethnocentric because we're taking all the basic things and saying, yeah, we're all the same. We're taking those fundamental categories and we're saying that my norm is the same as everybody's norm, okay? And my value is the same. And we're also making the effect of differences extremely superficial and marginal at best. And the human tendency, the human history has been to actually emphasize difference and exploit based on it, okay? So I want to talk about racism for a minute. In particular, because I run into people a lot now who, and this is a minimization strategy, they'll say, you know, why do we talk about race all the time? You know, this is a frequent pushback. And I want to tell you in the strongest of terms that I reject this point of view. And think and in fact, one of the most common strategies now is to refer to any effort to talk about diversity as politically correct. This is politically correct. That's an immediate strategy to marginalize. Okay, it's saying that working effectively across difference is not a theological imperative, but it's a political preference. Okay, and so I categorically reject the idea that diversity and our need to repair human communities and relationships across racial and other differences is politically correct. Actually, I see that as a strategy that is rooted in racism. Okay? It's rooted in racism. The United States in particular has a big cross to bear with respect to race. Our culture and society is not unique in its racist capacities. I think all cultures and societies have these capacities and tendencies. And that's an interesting thing, even in my career as a political scientist, from the 1990s to the present, as the Cold War diminished as the organizing principle for international relations, what we started to see is places like the Soviet Union that we thought were monolithic had a lot of difference in them. And those differences quickly became the basis for conflict. And so it's really interesting. Even our understanding of racism around the world has really changed. And conflict on the basis of all kinds of differences really changed in the wake of the Cold War, at least from a social science point of view. But the United States has a particular cross to bear here that is unique and profound and still with us. Our society, one of the things that American society has as a benefit is that we don't have an ethnic identity that roots our national identity. That's a good thing, okay? In Germany, being German, ethnically, German in your DNA matters first, and then other things matter later. Even after Nazism and so on, even to be a German citizen, if you're a third generation Turk, it can still sometimes be hard to become a German citizen in Germany. So that's a racialized society in a way that being part of a particular ethnic group implies a kind of membership. So one of the good things in U.S. society is that we don't have that explicit. But implicitly, we're a highly racialized society. And at the founding of the society, slavery was legal. In fact, much of the country's economy was built upon this institution. And even today's politics and cultural conflict is still rooted in these differences. And it can be hard to see. But it's deeply embedded in our psyche and in our culture. And I will tell you a series of things that I have done to not take this reality seriously, to not stare it in the face. First thing, when I graduated from my undergrad program, I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, from the West Coast to Nashville, Tennessee. You know, and I was interested, but I was a little worried because, you know, in my mind, I kind of thought, well, that's where the racists are, the South. That's where the racists are. You know, as though there weren't anywhere I was coming from. I mean, I was like 30 miles away from northern Idaho where the neo-Nazis were hanging out, and I thought I was going to where the racists were, you know? I mean, I really didn't think that went through very well. So I was going to the land of slavery, and that should tell me something, that I thought of it in that way. That should tell me that I really hadn't come to grips with what my country and my culture and my society had created, sustained, and produced for centuries. And now, we were still living in the wake of what had been done. And as I came to know African Americans in Nashville and also white Southerners, one of the things that I realized was that because race had been so much a part of the conversation in Nashville, Tennessee by 1991, there were people, white Southerners, who had grown up and as trained racists who had the scales fall from their eyes and had become much more deeply aware of structural racism and cultural racism and institutional racism than I was, as they shared their stories with me and as they confessed the things that they had said and done and been a part of. And they were in the people that I came to really learn from and admire in a deep way. I realized that they were way ahead of me in, because they were acknowledging their complicity in a system and a structure that I had only begun to think about. And so that was a powerful learning experience for me. And so I guess I want to leave you with this, that racism is a particular sin of the United States, and it's not just rooted in slavery. There's been all kinds of exploitation of all kinds of racial and ethnic groups ever since our founding. Out west, for me, it's Asian Americans that were exploited, and Native Americans, and Latinos. Those are the groups that I was most familiar with. Each one exploited in particular ways within the political economy of the Western United States that have had lasting effects on those relationships. And Nashville, for me, was beginning to learn about the depravity of this institution of slavery and its permanence and endurance over time. And so I would respond to anyone who would say you know, why are we still talking about racism? It's just read history. Just read history. And it's going to be with us for a really long time. All right, but there's great hope. There's great hope, and I have great hope. Now, I want to make sure that this great hope doesn't just kind of make us feel better and erase all the challenges that are out there, because they're numerous and they're with us, and we can never forget that. But I'm a pretty optimistic person, and my optimism can sometimes lead me to forget that we still got a lot of work ahead of us. In fact, it often now disappoints me, because I remember when I was working on a particular curriculum related to some of this, and we you know, I'd meet some students and work with them, and I'd hear some things sometimes and be horrified, and then I think, oh, great. And then after 2 years, we're doing better, and everybody's better. I mean, they're learning and working and growing. And then we'd bring another freshman class in, and people would say things that were awful, and I'd be like, oh, no. You know, I was so surprised. I thought we were making progress here, you know. And what I've come to see is that this is lifelong and contextual. And even when I think I'm making progress, I can find a new thing that I'm not, a blind spot. Something I didn't see, something I didn't know. So the hope I have is in Jesus, and it's not, it's a Jesus whose grace and power is pervasive And he comes to save our sin-sick souls. But remember, the sin was pervasive throughout the whole creation. He comes to save our broken social order, too. Okay? And he comes to save us, but he comes to transform and to heal and redeem a broken world. He comes with the truth that reminds us we're created fearfully and wonderfully in God's image. He reminds us of that good truth we started with. And he comes to tell us the truth about the rules and privileges that we've created that have no place in the kingdom of God. No place in the kingdom of God. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, I would encourage you, and I'm not going to do it right here, go back and read in the book of John where Jesus encounters a Samaritan woman. Okay? The woman had two strikes against her. She was Samaritan. She actually had three. She was Samaritan. She was a woman. And she had many husbands. Okay? She had all the strikes against her. And what does Jesus do? He talks with her. And what do the disciples do when they find this out? They're horrified. What? You're talking to a woman. And Jesus goes, oh yeah, not only a woman. A Samaritan. What? A Samaritan? Oh yeah, and she also had some husbands. What? And you're talking to a rabbi? Rabbi, you're talking to her? I firmly believe that when we read that verse, or those verses, and we read that account, what we are hearing is the gospel come to a broken society and a broken culture and a broken world, where all of these rules that we create without thinking, that exploit differences, and create a structure where there are lesser people and greater people, Jesus comes to confront those and challenge those and root those out. He comes to banish the sins of racism and sexism to hell. That's why he comes. And he comes to invite you and me into this project, which is the redeeming and restoring of the world on new terms. So in the text that I referred to, we see that Jesus does this, actually. He not only is going to say to the disciples, this isn't just about a drink of water, but he stays there for a couple of days in that community. He takes up residence to be in relationship and to educate. And that's where the powerful lessons are to me, that we've got to be in relationship and we've got to educate ourselves and each other about this. And so education and relationships in this biblical account work together as the tools of transformation. And that's what we need. All right, so where do we go from here? Because I think we're also pretty good these days at talking aspirationally about these things. What's hard is to actually do the real work, to actually get down and get serious about it. And that's where Calvin College is today. We've done a great job of espousing the aspiration, and now we need to get down to work. And we need to get down to work in our everyday activities. Because we need to move beyond minimization. We need to move to those other levels of development. And just briefly, there's three more stages in this model, three more levels of awareness. The acceptance of difference, the adaptation to difference, and then the integration of difference, where difference actually becomes something to be understood, appreciated, valued, where we in our minds need to be able to shift and adapt to different kinds of conversations, where we integrate that fully into how we think and how we behave. Now, what's challenging here is if I could give another three lectures on a topic like this, and probably would have only three people left by the end of the conversation. Because there's a lot of paths that diverge. There's a lot of growth that needs to happen for individuals, for me, for you. Then there's a lot of growth that needs to happen for organizations in this regard. Okay. And so I'm going to just talk a little bit more about organizational change and kind of where I hope we're going as a college. I'm only skimming the surface because we've got a lot that we could talk about here. But one of the things that I've noticed in organizations is that when people see the need for change, and especially people who have a kind of prophetic insight that I think is godly and it's of God, they've been given the prophetic insight, how do they feel? They see the injustice and they don't see change. How do you feel?
Frustrated.
What?
Frustrated.
Angry. Right. It's clear. Demoralized, marginalized, all those kinds of words, right? That's how we feel when we see these things. And when we feel like we're taking one step forward and two steps back, and we feel frustrated.
And so those with the prophetic insight see this. And what we often do is we keep our efforts up on the cognitive level. We try to create change just by going right at the problem. There's racism here. And people are going, what racism? There's privilege here. What privilege? We're all the same. You know, minimize. And what happens is organizations get stuck. Now, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I'm still learning about it, and I will be learning about it for years to come, I hope. But one of the insights that I've had from doing some reading and then just thinking about my own life and thinking about the organizations that I've been a part of is it wasn't until, really, we get down to the emotional level and we get down to being vulnerable emotionally and psychologically, all of us as an organization, that we begin to really make the change. We begin to go deep enough to really make a meaningful difference. But that's very hard. In most workplace cultures, that's not valued, going deeper. But what we have to do is enter into relationships where we're going to take risks and be vulnerable and begin to try to trust. And we're going to get burned sometimes, too. That's emotional work. That's really hard work. But we're not really being honest until we get down to that work. I've seen in my own experiences, I watch myself. I entered into this workplace culture as an outsider. Didn't know it. Didn't know people. Knew a few people, but didn't know it. And all last year, I could tell. I was guarded. I was careful. I didn't know where the landmines were. I didn't know what I shouldn't say. I didn't know what I should say. And I'm the president. But we're guarded. So it was hard to be vulnerable. And it was a very understandable self-protective mechanism. It's understandable. But I could see that I wasn't really going to become a part of this community, and I wasn't going to feel a part of this community until I became more vulnerable, and until I started to take risks, until I started to be bold, until I started to admit that I don't have it all figured out, until I started to partner with other people who knew more, a lot more than I did, not only about Calvin College, but about the history of this place, especially with regard to racism and other important differences. And so that's where I am now. I'm in partnership with really good people. Really good people. And we're starting to walk down a road and having honest conversations, and it's very, very good. So what's the vision? The vision is to make meaningful change to the structure and the system and the culture of Calvin College for the long run. That's the goal. I want, for Calvin College, I want all of us, students, faculty, staff, trustees, to develop our competence, our ability to work across differences effectively. So it means we have to know more. It means we have to learn more. It means we have to ask more. We have to be students constantly. We need to develop our capacity to work across differences as well. It's relational work. It's labor. And so we're going to need resources for it as well. And we're going to need to put time and money into that. Now, those are things, I think, that will help improve the climate, okay? The climate of race on campus and any other differences. We've got to work to understand where the climate is, and we've got to set some goals about where we want the climate to be. And we can set those goals knowing that on some of them we will probably fail. But if we fail, at least we'll know what we need to work on. That's what failure does for us. And that's what it means to be really vulnerable, is to be willing to be transparent about your failures. That's vulnerability. And then finally, if we do those things better, I think composition will come. I think, in other words, we will have a more diverse composition over time as we begin to work on those things. Now, there are some that would say that you need to work on composition first and then you work those other things. I think we need to work on all of them at the same time and make progress everywhere. But that's what we are intending to do. I think that's where I will end. I want to share an important book for me that I was handed as an undergraduate, but it was The Souls of Black Folk. Really powerful story. The story and the insight and the experience of W.E.B. Du Bois. I think if you want to understand
this country. I say this to people visiting this country. Two books you ought to read are written actually by outsiders to this country and its history. This book, An African American Writing and Reflecting on Life in America. And the other one is Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, Frenchman Coming to the Society, Loads of Questions. Those two books are the books that, if you want to understand the United States, what I recommend. But I'm going to read a beautifully written prayer that he writes. He calls it the afterthought at the end of the book. And it's his. And when I think of him praying this for our future, I can think of a lot of ways that these prayers have been answered. He was a deeply faithful man. But I can also think it's a prayer that's just as relevant today. It's written in beautiful English, but not the accessible English that we enjoy from the Message today. So I'm going to read through it twice. Hear my cry, O God, the reader. Vouchsafe that this, my book, fall not stillborn into the world wilderness. Let there spring, gentle one, from out its leaves, vigor of thought, in thoughtful deed to reap the harvest wonderful. Let the ears of a guilty people tingle with truth. Listen to that. Let the ears of a guilty people tingle with truth. My ears are tingling. And 70 millions sigh for the righteousness which exalteth nations. In this drear day, when human brotherhood is mockery and snare, thus, in thy good time, may infinite reason turn the tangles straight, and these crooked marks on a fragile leaf be not indeed. It's a very hopeful prayer. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Comments, questions, thoughts?